morning.
In about a month's time, I'm going to be leaving for the country of India, Lord willing, to preach the gospel. And I'd ask that you keep me in prayers. I'll be traveling with Brother Dan Torres from Bellingham, Washington, a friend that I've known over the years. And I thought that inasmuch as that is going to take place in the will of God, that it might be helpful to have a presentation about the work over in India so that Christians here can know more about it and know then more effectively how to pray for the labors that are taking place over there. Now, India is a very large country out over there in the east, and if you were to take India itself, just the country there in terms of its land, and transfer it over, say, to the United States, you could see how just visually as you look at the size, as you look at the dimensions of the country, that quite easily it would extend all the way from Canada down deep into Mexico. So it is a large country in terms of land, not quite as large as the United States, but it is larger than the United States in terms of population. We have roughly 320 million people here in this country today, though it's always growing in numbers. But over there in India, you have 1.25 billion people. A lot of souls there that are in need of the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. In our first trip, which was now about a decade ago, 2007, we flew into Bangalore, and then we traveled from Bangalore up to Kurnool, where we did most of our preaching and teaching. We were about the business of training preachers there so that they could be established in the faith, that they might in turn carry the gospel to those that were within their communities. The distance there from Bangalore to Kurnool is about 225 miles. It was a journey of about 5 hours to get there. And I saw a lot. It was quite the eye-opening experience, especially as I started out there in Bangalore, as we started out there in Bangalore and made our way up there to Kurnool. And so I'm going to show you some pictures of what it was that we got to witness there. You're looking here now first at a photograph of Joshua Mahendranath's family. Now, Joshua Mahendranath was our main contact over there, and it's my understanding he shall be our main contact when we go back here now in this coming month of November. But we also have here in this photograph the men that I traveled with the first time. There was Joe Price from Bellingham, Washington. Dan Torres, also there from Bellingham. He himself is not a full-time evangelist, but he is a businessman, and he has used much of his own resources to be able to provide for his trips out over there in previous years, and he has been encouraging me to come back with him, so I'm looking forward to that opportunity. Bobby Holmes was also there in that first trip. He is of age to where he cannot return, he cannot go back. Bobby Holmes lives out in Mansfield, Texas, and Leroy Kleiss was also with us from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. India is a land of temples and idols, and I cannot stress this enough. It was so unique a situation for me. It felt, to some extent, that I had been plucked right off the planet Earth and, say, transferred over to the planet Mars, and I was having to almost preach to Martians. It was just that surreal of an experience. And so not only are you around a lot of people that look very different from yourself and speak very differently, but their religion is wildly different. And so they will have these temples that are strewn out all over their country where you're going to see their pantheon of gods and goddesses that are sprawled out on the roofs of those temples. On this journey up to Kurnool, I had a photograph here that I was able to take of a temple off there in the distance, just to give you an example of this. And so you have a temple off there in the distance, and the driver there on his dashboard, our driver there in this cab, had an idol right up there on his dashboard, a Ganesha idol, which we'll say more about. If you don't have a car, then there are other ways to get around in the country of India. You could just hitch up a wagon there to the Brahma bulls. The bull is very sacred over there. They will not eat cows. They will not eat beef. And I couldn't help but notice this as we were making our journey, that here you have a Brahma bull that is painted pink. Painted pink to be used evidently in some elaborate ceremony or ritual over there. Traffic was horrendous. Traffic was a nightmare, especially there in Bangalore itself, and I'm sure it would hold for any major city out there in India. If we think it's pretty bad in Atlanta, then we haven't quite seen anything just yet. Over there in Bangalore, it did not seem that there was much rhyme or reason to rules for the road. You could pass there on the right, you could pass on the left. It seemed like they could just travel at whatever speed they wanted to travel at. They knew how to turn a two-lane road into about six lanes, it seemed like. And so I'm gripping my seat there, hanging on for dear life half the time. You can just see also situations where they're a bit of a head-scratcher. Pedestrians, in spite of the fact that cars and motorcycles are moving very fast, speeding hither, thither, and yon, you're going to have pedestrians just meander out there into the road as though nothing's happening around them. And you can see here this man walking down the middle of the road here, almost oblivious to what is there to his left and to his right. And so on account of that, there are in fact some critics there in the country. We like you, but not your rash driving. So I spotted a few of these signs and decided to try to grab a picture if I could as we were making the journey up there to Kurnool. Here you can see this girl in traditional India clothing, and she's just walking very nonchalantly, even though right behind her you'd have some cabs, some taxis that are speeding up pretty fast behind her. That's the standard look for their taxi out over there. It looks pretty much like a motorcycle or a tricycle that has a tarp stretched over the back of it. And they are, if I might use a bigger word, ubiquitous. They're just found all over the place out there. This was the first restaurant that we stopped at when heading up north. And I was treated then to my first authentic Indian meal. And I learned that this would ultimately become like my daily food rations while out there. This is a staple. This is what they call a dosha. A dosha. Now, in my opinion, it tasted somewhat like a greasy pancake, to put that in perspective for you. They roll it up like a burrito. And what you have there on the inside of this would be just like a little bit of potatoes. Not much at all. So it's primarily bread that you're eating there. It was not really suitable for my tastes, my taste buds, but it's very popular out over there. And they love their sauces, they love their spices, the curry over there. And so you just dip that bread in there. Now, here in our country, we're used to a great diversity of food. And so you have the liberty to go out, say, to an Italian restaurant, and then maybe the next day you could go to get some burgers and fries and a shake, or then the next day you could go out for Mexican food, or the next day you could go out to like a Chinese buffet. But over there you don't really have such options, or they're just not really as abundant. They are very particular about their palate and their food taste, and so this is almost like their version of their country cooking, and that's what they like, and they don't really venture much further beyond this. As we were heading up there, it started to get pretty late. It was getting pretty dark, and we stopped at a gas station to gas up, and I stepped out to stretch my legs, and Joshua Mahendranath also came out there with me, and there was a billboard that was right by that gas station, and he pointed up to it, and he said, "Do you happen to know who that man is?" Now, the billboard was saying, "Help ever, hurt never." Well, I said, "No, I don't have the foggiest, not the faintest clue as to who that man is. How could I ever know anything like that?" And then he explained, "That man is Sai Baba, and he is a man who claims that he is a god." Now, that caught my interest, and so I moseyed on over there to that billboard, and I took some flash photography to get a better picture of this man. So come to find out, he is perceived to be a miracle worker over there. And people will travel literally hundreds of miles to hear him speak, and also perhaps to receive a blessing from him. We are familiar with faith healers here in our country, but as far as I know, we don't really have many that would claim to be God or a God or an incarnation of a God. But that's the case over here with Sai Baba. And he is greatly beloved, actually, in their culture. So not only do you find him there on billboards as you're driving along, but even within public buildings, you're going to find his picture, his photograph. Unfortunately, I did get sick on the first trip out there. And so for a few days, I was laid up at the hospital. And I couldn't help but notice there in the hallway of that hospital, you had a photograph of Sai Baba. And so just maybe the picture itself of this man brings comfort and consolation to a lot of people out over there. This is what we're encountering as we're going over there to preach the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. Even there within a coffee shop, I couldn't help but notice a photograph of Sai Baba. And I'm going to now give you a close-up here of his photograph, and you'll observe how it is that there are some red dots there on his picture. We know that Hindu people will have a red dot very often there on their forehead, and that causes a question mark to emerge in our mind. Why is that done? What's the significance of that? And it's put there with red paste, and when you look at their religious beliefs, what you find is that that is in fact a signal that one is a Hindu. So even if we were going to, say, make a fashion statement, we were not going to dare be seen out there in India with a red dot on her forehead. But according to the religious beliefs, that red dot is supposed to represent a third eye. A third eye. Now, they understand it's a different type of eye. We have two physical eyes with which we can see and perceive the physical world. But this red dot is supposed to be a third eye, a spiritual eye, where they're given then now allegedly insight into the spiritual realm, the spirit world. As we were driving along, I had my camera on the ready, and I could not help but notice this very large idol that was laid out horizontal. And to put it in perspective here for you, that's about 100 feet in length. 100 feet in length. So I did some research here on this particular idol. He's known as the sleeping giant, Kumbhakarna. Kumbhakarna. Now, he is not done up to scale, because I pointed out he is 100 feet there in length, all right? But according there to their religion, he was about 1,000,000 feet tall. 1,000,000 feet tall. And they believe that he once lived. He's now dead, but they say that he once walked the earth. The cruising altitude for like a 747 would be at about, what, 45,000 feet tops. So can you picture now a man here that's 1,000,000 feet in height? That would put his head up there into outer space. He'd have a little difficulty with oxygen, wouldn't he? But here, according now to all of this story, Kumbhakarna was basically given an opportunity to receive a blessing from the creator god, Brahma. And as he was going to ask for Indrasan, which translates as the seat of Indra, one of their chief gods, there was a goddess, allegedly, that tied up his tongue. So instead of asking for Indrasan, seat of Indra, he asked for Nedrasan, which meant bed for sleeping. And so the creator god Brahma then gives him this bed of sleeping, and he says, I'm going to make you fall asleep, almost in an eternal sleep there. Well, his brother wasn't too happy with it. Now, the brother happened to be very standard-sized, as we are. And so the brother makes a case here and says, no, this cannot be. There was some foul play. There was some sinister scheme worked up here, concocted. And so he tries to reason there with Brahma, and Brahma says, all right, well, at the end of 6 months, he can rise for one day. And so there, according to this story here, he gets up at the end of 6 months for one day. And he'll go around and he'll terrorize villagers. He would eat entire flocks and herds of livestock. That's how the story goes. Now, as you look there at the Hindu religion, to us here in the States, to us as Westerners, it comes across very much like a comic book type religion. You see over here, if you were to go there to the grocery, I don't know that's so much like this anymore today, but there was that time in which near the checkout, you could have a rack for the comic books. And we know about Spider-Man, we've seen the Incredible Hulk, we know about Superman or the Fantastic Four, where you've got maybe characters that can stretch or characters that can combust. But we understand, even the littlest among us tend to know, that that is a make-believe world. That is a fantasy world. That's not reality. But when you look there at the particulars of the Hindu religion, it comes across to us, and I don't mean to belittle all of this, but it comes across to us here in the States as being very much like a comic book type religion. Over there, they have their gods and goddesses with faces that are painted blue, faces that are green. They've got animal faces. They'll have multiple limbs and appendages, and it's all very fanciful to us over here. But make no mistake, children over there are being taught that these characters are real, or were real. In the case of Kumbhakarna, who's now dead, but they've got an idol to him. He's worshipped. And so even today, children can read books on Kumbhakarna and what it was that he did here in this world. This is what we deal with as we go over there to preach. Idols are in abundance, temples are everywhere, and while India is quite the poor country, you can see how a lot of the financial resources have been concentrated there on their religion. And so these are almost as their elaborate cathedrals. Precious stone is done up in some of these temples. It was our hotel that we were going to stay at, and you can see how it is that they've got some scaffolding over here made out of basically pieces of wood. It was the Moria Inn that we stayed at, and it happened to be one of the finer ones there in Kurnool. This was the room that I was in. Much of the furniture, the bed itself, would be relatively low to the ground, like it is there, say, maybe in other parts of Asia. Here is a picture of our bathroom, and we would take what was called a splash bath. So we don't have the traditional shower head over there, but you'd have like a spigot, the faucet there, and you fill your bucket up with water, and then you can just splash that on your body and dry off with a little towel. There was no shower curtain here at all, so when you walk in, you pretty much just see the drain on the ground where the water would go from your bath, and then you'd also have the sink on this side over here and the commode over on that side there, all put together. Here was our security, and this was our night watchman over there, and I could not help but think this would be great for a picture. He's passed out, fast asleep there. But that aside, we did feel pretty safe all over there. We were in good care with Joshua Mahendranath and other Christians. It was a relief to be able to meet the men finally that we would be laboring with and working with. In the course of our visit out there, we had about 170 men that we were helping to train and establish in the Word of God. And the topics would sweep the spectrum from the plan of salvation to the work and organization of the church, the worship of the church, and we would answer questions that they would have. One of the first orders of business was to pass out Bibles. We take for granted the access that we have to the Bible out here. That's not enjoyed in every part of this world. And I mean, now with our computer technology, just a few clicks of the fingertips, we can have access to multiple translations of the Word of God. But over there, that's not the case. That's not the situation. And so you can have settings where an entire congregation might just possess one or two copies of the Bible. And I have here with me a Bible in the Telugu translation there. Now, Telugu is one of six languages spoken over there in India with the Christians that we were working with, primarily in the region that we were at there, Bangalore, Kurnool. They spoke Telugu, so we got copies of the Bible in Telugu. And we could not meet all the needs that were out there. We did our best with the men that came, 170. We tried our best to give them copies of the Bible. We had to limit it. We had to restrict it for each individual, how many they'd get to take back to their own respective congregations. But here you know, you're looking at one class session with these men. And we got right to work, teaching and teaching and teaching and preaching. The Apostle Paul told his son in the faith, Timothy, the things that you've heard from me, among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. And so that's the end goal that we have here in mind. We're there preaching, yes, to make converts, but also to establish other gospel preachers who in turn can carry the message out to others when we are gone and back here in the States. So Dr. Boney was one of our translators, one of our main translators, and I was really impressed about his story. He had been a Hindu, but he was doing soul searching. He saw that there were a lot of fanciful tales connected with Hinduism. He saw through a lot of that there, and so his heart was touched upon hearing about the story of Christianity. And he was converted first to the Baptists. But as he studied more about the plan of salvation that's found there within the New Testament, he discovered that baptism was for the remission of sins, and so he wanted to make sure that he did all of that correctly and right. And he became a convert, and he is in the Church of Christ. Now, he had been initially with a liberal congregation, institutionally minded congregations. And so, as teaching was done out there, he learned about the pure gospel of Christ. He learned about the pattern for the work and organization of the New Testament church, and his heart was very tender. And so he responded to that and came out of liberalism, came out of the social gospel, a corrupt gospel. And he gave me a pamphlet here, which is actually like a little hymnal, a little songbook there in the Telugu language. But up on top of it, he has there, "Abandon liberalism and preach the pure gospel." So I was really impressed with this man, and he's doing his part now to spread simple New Testament Christianity that's free from denominational trappings. Here he is translating for Brother Dan Torres, the man that I'll be going with here in November. We brought our projectors to put PowerPoint up there, but electricity can in fact be hard to come by at certain times. When you're doing preaching over there, you have to cut standard lessons in half pretty much, or maybe even more so, because whatever you say, the translator has to think about how it's to be processed and refurbished and put out in their vernacular. And so that takes some time. That takes some time. And here you can see Sudhakar Boney working with me as the lesson is being brought. Wherever the gospel goes, so goes opposition. It was true in Bible times. It's true even today. You can just look there at the travels of the Apostle Paul, and when he would go about, there were those like Elymas the sorcerer who sought to turn the deputy from the faith. There were those like Demetrius the silversmith who made silver shrines of Diana, who did not care for the teaching of the Apostle Paul. And so even here today, as you go to various parts of this world, there's going to be opposition. And Jacob Chucka was one who was receiving a lot of money from various churches of Christ here in the States. Money was being funneled to him, so he was becoming like a one-man depot station to in turn disperse that money out to other preachers. The only problem with that is it's just not found in the New Testament. So you can see how this man started to gain a lot of inherent authority there with a lot of the people of India, and he could pull strings to suit his own fancy. Well, as we came there preaching about how matters were done in the New Testament, it's no surprise he did not really care for that. And he did his part then to try to misrepresent us, to try to discourage these preachers from coming to hear the messages. And so we had to meet that head on. And now you have Joe Price here, as you can see in this picture, giving a lesson on open response to Jacob Chucka's open letter. This is Brother David Jeremiah. David Jeremiah. And his story really struck a chord with me. He had been in the Baptist church, but he learned about New Testament Christianity, and so he was converted out of denominationalism. But according to his testimony, he was actually physically assaulted for his conversion. He was physically beaten up for his stand for the truth. He and other men have the practice of going out into the jungle, out into the remote parts of India to preach and to try and find souls there that they can teach about Jesus Christ. And we inquired more about that, saying, now, when you go out there into the jungle, where exactly do you stay? Where do you sleep? And he said, oh, we sometimes just find a clearing there. I find like a grove there within the trees. And that's where we'll set up, and that's where we will sleep for the evening. Well, are you safe? I mean, do you hear a lot of noises out there, a lot of sounds that might spook you or scare you? He said, oh, yeah, we do hear about a lot of that. We do. Now, you know, you've got tigers over there in India, elephants. He's pretty brave to do this, he and other gospel preachers, but they're hardworking, wanting to save the lost and bring them to the Lord Jesus Christ. The man that you see over here, on the right, he was a former leader in the Communist Party of India. But his heart was touched with the gospel, and so he was converted. And he also wants now to share the message of salvation with others as well as a gospel preacher. There's a great power in the gospel of Jesus Christ to transform the heart of stone. This man over here that has a crutch under his arm was also very impressive to me. Now, he's also here pictured with his son. Both of them are gospel preachers. But he's on a crutch for this reason here. He just happens to have one leg. He's a one-legged preacher, but I learned his story here. He is preaching, get this, for three different congregations, three churches of Christ that he will go to on a Sunday to speak for and to be of service at. I tell you what, if he can do that with one leg, what can we as Christians do with both of our legs? Got to do some thinking. The healthcare system is not very strong out there at all in India. And so you see circumstances that are just heartbreaking, that'll really just tug at your heartstrings. And here you can see this woman on the streets. She has no legs, and she's begging for money. Here was another man, and you can see how his legs are bent out of shape. It's a fairly common occurrence out over there. A fairly common sight that you see matters just like this. Matters which would be quite shocking to us here in the States if we were to see that with individuals just on the sidewalks. Here was a man who made a bed here at a gas station. And this little girl was a girl that I would never forget. She came up to us and started to tug on the pant legs and tug on our shirts. And she had a pan there with her. As you'd suspect, she's looking for some money, looking for a contribution. But she obviously did not speak English, and so she was trying in some way to communicate with us, and she kept with her hand coming up there to the mouth as if to say she needed to eat. She needed food. And so I dipped into my pockets there to pull out some money to give to her. But the part that really stuck out to me was this. And I wish now that I had taken a photograph of this part. Down there at her feet, she had had a basket. She'd had a basket. And during her little episode of trying to get our attention here, she had picked up that basket. And she opened up that basket. And you know what was inside? A snake. A serpent. Now, for a lot of us, we'd just jump back and say, whoa, what's that all about there? I mean, I'll give you some money, but I don't want to see that at all. And they've got the cobra out there in India, poisonous snakes. Now, I got to thinking about that. Now, she could not speak English, so she could not really tell me what that was all about. But Where we were at, now this is a picture taken in Bangalore. Where we were at was just right out in front of a shopping center. And behind that shopping center, you had this. You had a 65-foot statue of Shiva, who is the Lord of Serpents. So, again, I could not directly communicate with her, but I started to put some of this together. And potentially, now this is just my guess about it, my surmising, she might have been saying, do right by Lord Shiva and help. Shiva, even here with this statue, has a snake that's wrapped around his neck. I mean, can you imagine going over here to the Sugarloaf Mills Mall, the Discovery Mills Mall here, and right there in the parking lot of that mall, seeing a 65-foot statue of Shiva? That's India for you. That's India for you. And then out in front of that statue, you had his son, Ganesha, this elephant-headed god. Ganesha, without question, is the most popular god over there. An elephant-headed boy. You can see with this temple that was there in Bangalore, they've got their pantheon with various poses, some dancing and prancing around on the rooftop there. But above all of them is Ganesha. And Ganesha here is done up by artists in different ways and in different venues and forms. But he is their most popular one. And with that particular temple, which I just showed you the roof of, I dared not go in, but with my camera I tried to zoom in to the best of my ability. And sure enough, there you could see an idol to Ganesha there with that trunk that's extending down from his face. And you could also see this woman here praying before that idol. Here is a Hindu priest blessing a van. And when I saw this, I said, now I think I've seen about everything. So while I'm sure they have insurance over there, here's some additional care that you can receive. And here the priest is marking it up with some white paste. And allegedly now this van will receive even greater protection from any damages it might incur. Here's a woman dealing in idols. You see the idols up there on her table. Trying to sell all of that. Muslims are prominent in India. They make up about 15 to 20% of the population out there. 80% would be Hindu. But Muslims are there. They do not get along with the Hindus at all. And Hindus do not care too much for them. But just as you would see the Hindu temples, you're also going to see from time to time the mosques that are set up out there. Jainism is another major religion in India. But now this religion here is more like a religion of compromise. They would say that there is truth found in Hinduism, there's truth found in Islam, there's truth that is found in Buddhism, there's truth found in all of these, quote, major religions of the world. And so it's a religion of compromise, a blend of all of them. You can see all of the time and attention that goes into these temples. It's big business out over there. Here's a man that's working to paint a column that's there with one of those Jain temples. There you can see some of the worshipers. Buddhists are in India as well. Tibetan Buddhism seems to be pretty prominent out there. There you can see a picture of the Dalai Lama right on the dashboard of the vehicle, the van, that those Buddhists had been driving. For a few days, we preached there in Bangalore as well. We'd been up there primarily in Kurnool, training gospel preachers. But we also made sure to come there to Bangalore to do preaching. And Brother Balswami opened up his house there for a gospel meeting effort. Balswami is the brother, the physical brother of Joshua Mahendranath. And he was converted through the efforts of Joshua Mahendranath. Joshua's story is very impressive in its own right. He had obeyed the gospel out in Kuwait. He worked there as an engineer out in Kuwait, but he came back there to India, and with great zeal and enthusiasm, he started to convert people by the dozens. And through his influence, Balswami was also converted in time. And he's also working on other members of the family too. You'll observe that they have the practice of sitting on the floor. They don't quite have pews like we do. And in most cases, you're going to find that the women are on one side and the men are on another side. They separate that way. Prasad was our primary driver out there. And his story is quite fascinating to me. Far as I know, he may well still be in Hinduism. But as he was taking us out, taking us to the places where we would have our preaching appointments, he would stay behind in his vehicle. We invited him to come in to hear some teaching, but said, nah, don't really care to do that. Well, as the days went on, we noticed that he would show up there in the back, and he would find a seat and listen. And so we'd ask a little more about that. You know, would you like a Bible study? Would you like to have some questions answered? He was very reluctant. But as the days went forward, he asked if he could have a copy of the Bible. And we said, sure. If you assure us that you're going to read this. He says, all right, I'll do that. And we pointed out that we wanted him to start there in the Gospels, chiefly with the Gospel of Luke. And then after completing the Gospel of Luke, he could naturally then go into the book of Acts and see the steps of salvation, the plan of salvation. And he was so excited about that, he said, yes, I'm going to be reading this every day. I will read this every day. And he said, I'm going to take it back to my parents. And I'm going to tell them about what it is that I'm learning. He started to ask all manner of questions about the afterlife, about what happens when we die. And he was just thrilled to start learning about all of this here. And so I'm hoping that as I go back now, 10 years later, right, we can hear about Prasad being converted by the gospel of Christ. There is a hunger for truth over there. Darkness is associated with idolatry. But people are yearning for something more because they recognize how that religion of Hinduism is woefully inadequate. And so let's do our part as Christians here to share the precious message of the Savior with this world. Let's not be relying on our own power or our own strength, but be relying upon God and His providential care to direct all of this. And God will take those that have the truth and guide them towards those that are in need of the truth. Let's not lose faith in that. Into our hands the gospel is given. Into our hands is given the light. Millions are groping out there without the gospel. What are we going to do? Let's do our part to preach the gospel of Christ. This is a commission that's given to you as it is given to me. How are we faring in this regard? Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. Let's get to work, because work is there to be done. If even here now, here this morning, you are not a Christian, become one this hour. We plead with you to do so. The gospel plan of salvation is very straightforward. It's very simple. What hinders you from being baptized? It would only be our pride. Let us with humility respond to that tender invitation so that heaven can be our home. If we can be of service, come to the front while together we stand now and sing.